On this episode of Risk, you'll hear...
And we're standing there, you know, in our underwear, two dudes holding butcher knives.
And you'll hear...
Didn't think I'd be doing so much centrifuging, but at least I'm still drowning in cum.
And of course me, Kevin Allison, on the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. Okay, folks, this episode of Risk is called Come and Go, and this is Bunker Buster behind me now. I'll tell you, my next online storytelling workshop starts on February 15th, 2026, at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. It'll happen 8 Sundays in a row like that on Zoom, so email me at kevin@risk-show.com to learn more about that. Now, in a little bit, we're going to hear from Sarah Adelman, but... to start things off, a story by the wonderful Ezra Holmland, who is now a Risk favorite. And for the first time, he recorded a story with us live on stage at Caveat in New York last September. So here's Ezra now with a story we call Things Are Going South.
So it was just one of those strange anomalies. Both my little brother and I, we were both leaving the country on the same day, both flying out of PDX, Portland. I was headed down to Antarctica to begin a six-month tour of duty working as a cook at the McMurdo Research Station. And my little brother, he was headed over to Amsterdam to go start living with his new girlfriend. So my parents, they still lived in Portland, so we decided to spend the night at their place, you know, before we flew out the next day, have a little family reunion. So we show up at my parents' place, we have dinner with them, we're sitting around the, you know, the dinner table, you know, talking about our new adventures. I was 27 at the time, little brother was 24. These are great ages for starting new adventures. So I'm headed down south to Antarctica. Little brother, he's headed over to Amsterdam. We're talking about these new adventures. It's a great time. So my parents, they have to work in the morning. And so they go to bed, but they live in a ranch-style house, you know, upstairs, but they have a basement. So we go downstairs. My flight was at like 3 in the afternoon. Brother's flight was at like 2 in the afternoon, so we could continue the party. So little brother and I, we go downstairs, you know, we're drinking beer. We hang out till like 1 in the morning or so, you know, having a good time, talking about these new adventures, all of our, you know, what we're going to do, this great adventure stuff, you know, we're having a great time. So I'm kind of surprised when my little brother, he taps me awake, you know, I'm laying in bed, he taps me awake. I look over at the alarm clock, you know, it says 7 a.m. and he's like, there's somebody in the house. There's somebody in the house. I look at my brother. I'm like, there's nobody in the house. And then I hear the footsteps upstairs. They're moving quick. They're going from the kitchen to the living room to the dining room. And these are definitely not the footsteps of my parents. They've obviously left and gone to work. So I stand up out of the bed just wearing my underwear. My brother's just wearing his underwear. And we're listening to the footsteps upstairs. I'm like, oh, shit. So we hear the footsteps. They go into my parents' bedroom, open the door, and they just start rifling through the drawers, just like tearing the place apart. I'm like, oh, shit. Oh, shit. Now, this is the time when cell phones, you know, had just started. I did not have one. Neither did my brother. But there was a landline downstairs. So I say to my brother, I was like, hey, you call 911. I was like, I'm going to go upstairs and I'm going to get weapons. I did not grow up in a house with guns, but there were knives in the kitchen. So the way that the house is set up, the stairs lead up kind of into the dining room close to the kitchen. And I tiptoe up the stairs and I'm listening to the sound of this guy in my parents' bedroom just fucking tearing the place apart. I walk up into the kitchen, I grab a couple of butcher knives, you know, off the rack, and I tiptoe back downstairs, and my brother, he's on the phone talking to the 911 operator, like, we live at 14233 Southeast Stevens, there's somebody in our house, there's somebody in our house, there's somebody robbing us. You know, so I walk back down the stairs, you know, and I hand my brother a butcher knife, you know, and I've got one in my hand. So we're sitting there, we listen to the guy. He's up in my parents' bedroom, and then he goes down the hallway. He goes into bedroom number two, and he starts tearing that bedroom apart, just ripping it apart. So I'm thinking at this point, you know, we have a limited amount of time. Like, this guy, eventually, he's going to come downstairs, you know? He's going to find us, you know? And I was thinking, like, this is kind of a fight or flight situation. I was thinking, like, maybe we should just hide in a closet, you know? But then I thought about our obituaries, you know what I mean? Two brothers found cowering in the closet, you know? You know, murdered, you know, it's like, that's not going to work. That's not going to work. This was a fight situation. You know, I was going south. I was going to Antarctica. I was not going to let this guy ruin my new adventure. So I say to my brother, I was like, I'm going to scare him out of the house. I'm going to scare him out. Brother looks at me like, I don't think this is a good idea. You know, my thought process being, you know, like, he had no idea that we were in the house. He had no idea what weapons we had. So I say to my brother, I'm gonna go upstairs and I'm gonna scare him out of the house. He's like, okay, I don't think this is a good idea. So I tiptoe up the stairs. We go up the stairs, go into the dining room, and then start going toward the living room where it leads to the hallway where he is in all these bedrooms. And we hear this guy, he goes down to the last bedroom. He's in bedroom number three, so he's coming out soon. So as I get around the corner going into the living room, I notice a pile of drywall debris right in front of the fireplace. And I look up, and there's a hole in the ceiling. Meaning, this guy had been in our attic, and he had fallen through the ceiling. He'd been up there, and, like, you know, you have to, like, step on the rafters. No, this guy was not smart enough. He'd been up in our attic, just stepped through the drywall, boom, fell through the ceiling. And that's just a whole nother level of crazy, you know what I mean? Or lack of intelligence. So I'm doubting my plan at this point. I'm thinking to myself, I don't know if this is a good idea, you know? But I'm kind of all in at this point. I'm kind of all in. I have to give an Oscar-winning performance. So I'm standing there, you know, I kind of look like Iggy Pop, and, you know, with a butcher knife in his underwear. I'm a pretty small guy, you know. My little brother, he's behind me. He's not much bigger than me, you know, not a lot of muscle. So I really need to deliver like an epic Emmy-winning performance. So I figure if he comes out of that door, you know, I'm going to block and stab. So I'm standing there, I crouch down, and I get ready for it, you know, and I'm like, all right, build myself up, and then I let it rip. I'm like, all right, motherfucker, I got a gun, and I'm going to come in there, and I'm going to fucking shoot your ass. I'm going to fucking shoot your ass on the count of three, motherfucker. 1, 2, 3. And then I just hear this chaos of sound, just this cacophony, just like things shattering, going everywhere, and then the glass shattering, and then it's quiet. Plan worked. Plan actually worked. Dude jumped out of the window. So I'm standing there just like hyped up on adrenaline at this point. I'm shaking. I'm looking at my brother. It's like, what do we do now? He's like, I don't know. It's like, I think we should get out of the house. The cops are coming. We should get out of the house. He's like, yeah. It's like, I don't think we should go out the front door. Maybe he's right there. It's like, okay. So we decide to sneak out of the back of the house. We go out on the opposite side where he jumped out of the window. So we creep up along the side of the house. We get to where the gate, you know, we unlock it, heads on swivels, just looking for this guy. And then we creep out to the street. We get to the mailbox, and we're standing there, you know, in our underwear, two dudes holding butcher knives, you know, looking around. And finally, we see the cops at the end of the street. Cop car comes or starts zooming toward us. And just this wave of relief washes over me, like, all right. Cops are here. Cops are here. Everything's going to be all right. So the cop car, it comes zooming toward us, screeches to a halt. Two cops jump out. They pull their guns. They're like, drop your weapons. Drop your weapons now. We throw our knives to the ground. We're like, we're the ones who made the call. We're the ones who made the call. This is 14233. My parents are Kevin and Matthew Holmlin. We're the ones who made the call. So the cops... One of the cops, he starts dialing the number on his phone, and the other cop, he's still skeptical. He's like, oh, yeah, if you're the son, so like, what were you doing in the house? We're like, we were flying out today. He's like, oh, yeah, where were you going? Little brother's like, Amsterdam? He's like, where were you going? It's like, Antarctica. Hand goes right back on the gun. We're like, whoa, 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 whoa. So the other cop, he's like, hey, he gets a hold of my parents. He's like, hey, hey, these are actually the sons. They're actually the sons. And the cop's like, everyone, let's just relax. Let's just relax. We're like, okay, okay, we're all relaxed. Yeah, we're all relaxed. And the cop's like, hey, can you bring us into the house? We're like, sure. So we bring him into the house, you know, find the little hide a key, walk in the front door. And as soon as you walk in the front door, you can see the pile of drywall debris in front of the fireplace. Cop looks up at the hole in the ceiling, and he looks at us, and he's like, he was in the attic? We're like, uh-huh. And it's like, what was he doing in the attic? We're like, I don't know. And he's like, was there anything, like, valuable in the attic? We're like, huh. And then the cop's radio starts beeping. He's like, beep, 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 beep. He's like, we have him in custody. We have him in custody. And the cop's like, hey, you guys just stay here. You just stay here. And the cop goes out toward the street. And of course, we follow him out to the street. And then we see the perpetrator, you know, he's being led up the street. You know, he's got two cops on each side of him. He's in handcuffs, you know. And this guy, he's wearing black jeans, a black shirt, long sleeve, and he has on a little black Stetson cowboy hat. And the look like the dude hadn't slept in years. He's just mad dogging everyone like, argh! So they stuff this guy into the back of the cop car, you know, and I'm looking at this guy, you know, and like at this point, you know, it had been a fight or flight situation this whole time, you know, where you stuff all your emotions down into the corner of yourself, but now they all just kind of start flooding back. I'm like, shit. I was like, you know, this could have really gone south on me, you know? This guy is definitely the type of guy, you know, who would have a gun. He could have just walked out and shot me, you know, like, bop, bop. You know, it's like it really could have gone south. And I start laughing to myself a little bit. It's important to find the humor in a situation. And I just kept on giggling to myself throughout the rest of the day, you know, like going south. Well, it turns out when you're starting a new adventure, you have no idea just how far south things are actually going to go, even if you're headed to Antarctica.
Folks, this episode of Risk is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know, I know so many friends who struggle because they feel like other people have it all figured out as far as romance or their sex lives go, or have it all together or got it all. Then I know so many other people who are deep in relationships and really feel like some problems in their relationships are intractable. So in February, you know, when it's Valentine's season, a lot of people get a little down in the dumps or a little anxious about all the roses and candies and flowers and whatnot. But the truth is, Everyone, me more than anyone maybe, is still learning, is still kind of figuring it out as we go. And therapy is a great way to work on that. BetterHelp therapists work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can really lay out your therapy goals. And if you find that you're not happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally, and an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. So, sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/risk. That's betterhelp.com/risk.
I'm Emma Greed, host of Aspire with Emma Greed, a podcast where I sit down with people who don't just dream big, they build big. From culture-shaping voices like Mel Robbins to leaders redefining success like Tracy Ellis Ross to game-changing entrepreneurs like Mark Cuban, Aspire is about mindset, ambition, and doing the work that actually moves the needle. If you're ready to raise your standards and take charge about the life and career you're building, Aspire is where you start. Follow and listen to Aspire with me, Emma Greed, an Odyssey podcast available wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back.
This is Risk. This is Bunker Buster behind me again, and we just heard from Ezra Homeland. You can check out Ezra's 9-part story about living as a fugitive across the world at EzraHomeland.com. Now, folks, I just uploaded a brand new check-in to our Patreon, a little, you know, letting everyone know how I'm doing now that I'm 4 months into making Bangkok my new home. And I wanted to share some thoughts and feelings about America, how we're all holding up. It's always top of mind for me, and so that is a very heartfelt and intimate check-in over there on Patreon. And speaking of Patreon, one of our Patreon patrons, John Helton, sent us this note with their contribution to help keep Risk running. John said, "I've been listening to this show religiously for almost 10 years. It's about goddamn time I stopped listening for free. Here's to hoping you reach your financial goals this year and everyone on the team can prosper. Thank you so much for your content and helping me grow as a person week after week." Man, thank you so much, John. Getting messages like that is, you know, a lot of what keeps us going. You know, a lot of what keeps us going is is the moral support, you know? Oh, my goodness gracious. Well, I'll tell you, to anyone out there, you too can join our Patreon and help us keep this show running and get bonus stories and an ad-free episode feed. You can watch our live shows, the video versions of them, and so much more. It's all at patreon.com/risk. Or you can send us a one-time donation at paypal.me/riskshow. Now, next up, a story from Sarah Adelman, recorded at the Risk Live Show at Caveat in NYC last June. So, here's Sarah Adelman now with a story we call The Long and Winding Road to Semen Analysis.
What's going on, y'all? You having a good time? We're having fun? Okay, awesome. I'm going to be telling you guys a story tonight about how I, for 2 years, had every little girl's dream job. I professionally studied semen. I worked at a sperm bank. Does anyone else? Just me? Okay, cool. I will never forget my first day of work. at a men's fertility clinic when a lab tech asked if I wanted to look down into a microscope, into a petri dish of millions of little sperm wiggling around. And I was like, wow, already? It's 9:08 a.m., okay? It's a little early for that. It was my first day, you guys. My first day, okay? They're like, Sarah, welcome to your new job. Here's your sexual harassment packet, and the cum's on your desk. But I'm not one to say no to a little no-strings-attached moment, so I look down into that microscope, into this petri dish of millions of little spermies wiggling around. And my eyes widened as I saw these creatures flopping furiously, looking for direction and meaning and attention. They seem to be screaming up, pick me, choose me, love me. And they reminded me so much of myself. You know, they had that anxious, nervous, vaguely disgusting vibe I think I've always had. And I'm looking down into this petri dish of sperm, and I see the needy, attention-starved kid I'd been looking up at me with pleading eyes. Now, before we go any further, I just want to say I am qualified to be a men's fertility scientist. I didn't just waltz into a sperm bank one day. Don't do that. It wasn't my original field of research, but the road to semen analysis is long and winding. Now, I have been studying semen recreationally for years before I started getting paid for it. Off the clock, freelance, pro bono, which is probably why I took the job. But I'm very qualified as well. I have a bachelor's in medical sociology. I have a master's of public health. And I trained for 2 years at an very prestigious undisclosed medical center here in New York. I can't say where. The NDA said I'd have to shoot you guys in the head. But you're just going to have to believe me on that one. I'm only bringing up my resume for you to understand that even though this is cum, it's serious cum. Okay. Great. I'm a very intense and controlling and type A person. And for me as a kid and growing up and coming of age, it wasn't enough for me to just approach my life as a scientist. I had to literally become a scientist. Like, careers in science get you on this gorgeous, clear template. It gets you on this conveyor belt, this hamster wheel, that if you just hop on and follow the steps, you'll have a good life. It's like bachelor's, master's, mental breakdown, research, PhD, start a dissertation, ignore all the published research that disproves your dissertation, graduate, research, mental breakdown, postdoc, retirement, beautiful. All I've ever wanted to do is just follow predetermined steps. Anything inside the Pandora's box of the future is terrifying to me. If being a control freak was a rash, I would be covered in red blotches, only helped by color-coded calendars and checklists. And in the real world, it's so hard to tell what's a signal and what's noise. Because the person I'm dating, my soulmate, how do I know if I'm ready to have kids? Should I quit my day job? Are my parents terrible people? Yes. But in science, you're God. Like, science is all about controlling X to see the effect on Y, taking confusing findings and summarizing them into easy-to-read figures. It's all right there. It's all black and white. You can't argue with a p-value. While my type A personality helped me in so many ways, it also did paralyze me in others. Like, as a kid, I would freak out if anyone was more than 5 minutes late to pick me up from school. I would want to call the police. My fingers would bleed from making so many multiplication table flashcards. I still have the callus. I would go to the bathroom during class and do jumping jacks because I'd learned in biology that oxygen helps neural pathways to the brain with memorization, which is a lot. And I felt like I was in a pressure cooker, you know, breaking down from the heat of my own temperature. And to me, with that kind of anxiety, a career in science with a predestined future was definitely the answer. And I took it happily. So I went to school, and then I went to grad school. And then I wanted to get a job in women's health, but no one was hiring. So I worked at a sperm bank, which sort of felt like the next best thing. We had a lot of guys come in. We were paying good money. We were studying microplastics and sperm. We were paying guys $75 to come to the lab and donate a sperm sample. Pretty good. An additional $25 if you referred a friend to our study. Yeah. An additional $25 if you jerked each other off and let me watch. Running out of money. Always drinking on the job. And these guys, like, I did feel bad about telling them I was going to pay them to masturbate. Because you know that saying, was monetize your hobby, lose the joy? Turns out they're fine, okay? They soldier on. It was weird being a female research scientist studying men, because you could see the ego just, like go up to their head, you know? They kind of puff out like peacocks. Like, I don't know what it was about coming to ejaculate at my place of work that made a lot of these guys think that we were on a date. But they would hand me their sad cup of sperm, low volume, and they'd be like, they'd be like, so, like, what's the move? Like, what's the move? I'm going to go make fun of your sperm count with my coworkers. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what you're talking about. Or these guys, this is so egotistical, they would all ask me the same question. They would be like, so, Sarah, now that you have my sperm, are you going to try to steal it to get pregnant? Every man that came in asked me that. And I'd be like, why would I want your cum, you know, from the guy who had 3 hours of free time in the middle of a work day? I mean, nobody wants 1 p.m. jizz, okay? Nobody wants your matinee cum, okay? I could go to any sperm bank in America and get sperm from, like, Olympic athletes. Me wanting cum from a guy like that would be like me going to Goodwill to get... come. You know what I mean? I don't want it. I really don't. So the job was cool. It was a cool job, right? It was funny and weird and gross, but I liked it, and I was doing real scientific research, and it was going great. But the only issue was that no one else who worked at the sperm bank thought that the job was funny. You know, they'd all be like, Sarah, semen is not funny. And I would be like, well, depends where it lands. You know what I mean? And I just felt like they were not, I have to like keep this poker face on all the time and pretend that like pipetting and analyzing jizz, excuse me, seminal ejaculate fluid, was very serious indeed. And so one day I felt like my brain was literally going to explode out of my ears. So I decided to do something that I'd always wanted to, but never had the guts. And I went all by myself to a stand-up comedy open mic in Brooklyn. And it didn't go very well, but I kept going back and I started getting better and better. And then it was 2 years later and I had this double life where I was this published research scientist from 9 to 5, and I was doing comedy at night. It was amazing. I had like the best of both worlds, but I was brunette in both of them. They said the Hannah Montana reference wouldn't land, but it did. Okay, so I'm living this amazing double life. Come with me, okay? It's 1 August, 5 o'clock in New York. I'm gathering my stuff at the lab, gonna take the subway home. We'd had a great week. We had just submitted this new abstract, and we were going to be applying to a conference in California, and I heard an email ping, and it was from my hospital's human resources department. And I was like, okay, promoted. Let's go. Going to get my raise. And they were calling me up to the 10th floor, and I walk in, and there's this big conference table, and there's a projector screen on the wall. And I'm introduced to 2 HR people, and a hospital compliance officer, and lawyers in suits in August. And they were like, Miss Adelman, please take a seat. We have a YouTube video we'd like to show you. And they pulled up a YouTube video of me doing stand-up, and they couldn't figure out the volume control on the projector, and it went so loud. They went, play, and I go on the screen, how's everybody doing tonight? I work at a sperm bank, every little girl's dream come true. Didn't think I'd be doing so much centrifuging, but at least I'm still drowning in cum. And then the lawyer paused the video on the subtitle, drowning in cum. And she turned around and looked at me and said, is that you? I was like, no. No, it is not. She said, really? That's not you saying that you work at a sperm bank, which is every little girl's dream come true, and you are drowning in cum. And I was like, not with that delivery. She didn't like that at all. No, they hit play again. In the video, I go, don't ever be rude to a scientist because I'm going in your chart and you're disgusting and I'm telling all my friends. It's not a HIPAA violation if you're gossiping, which is something I'm working out with HR right now. I was like, guys, that's pretty funny. I see the irony. They did not like that at all. She was like, Ms. Adelman, you do know it is a HIPAA violation, even if you're gossiping. I was like, I know that. That's why the joke's funny. She was like, well, I personally don't find it funny to joke about violating HIPAA. I was like, I don't find it funny to joke about joking about violating HIPAA. I didn't violate HIPAA, and I want you guys to know that. They were like, do you have anything else to disclose at this time? And I did not tell them that I had recently gotten in trouble with my own supervisor for taking all the guys who came out of the sperm bank and ranking them on a variable I created of 1 to 10 on how hot and funny I thought they were. And creating correlation matrices in Python to put that against their sperm quality. Allegedly finding a 0.74 positive correlation between how hot and funny I thought they were and their self-reported ability to maintain an erection. I scientifically proved big dick energy with a p-value of 0.01. Okay. We watched the 9-minute video in silence. All 7 of us. After which they slid me a 35-page printed transcript where they had transcribed every joke I had ever posted online. This is people with Yale law degrees sitting around typing out cum and jizz all day. It's like, do you guys need a fucking fidget spinner down in legal? Like, are you bored? And they said, Miss Adelman, you have grossly violated our employee code of conduct and we're terminating you. And I was like, for how long? And she was like, Sarah, you're fired. Me, fired. Me, violated a code of conduct. I was a girl who highlighted my school handbook at the beach on summer vacation. I love codes. I love conduct. I never even got detention. I tried to tell them that, but I just sounded like a celebrity getting a DUI, being like, do you know who I am? In my official termination letter, it says that I, quote, propagated negative gender stereotypes because I was making fun of the way that men were acting at my job. My permanent record has sexism against men on it. Me, kind of a card-carrying guy's girl, okay? I drink Coors Light, people. I'm the one who suggests no condom. I walked home in a stupor, trudging over the Williamsburg Bridge. I'd flown too close to the sun, the cum melting off my wings. I'd have to tell my parents. I mean, how do you tell your parents who paid for you to go to graduate school that overnight you had gone from working at the world's most prestigious hospital to being on Medicaid? It's not funny. That's my life. No, it is funny. I mean, I got home. I couldn't even, like, look my diplomas in the eye. You know, I was too ashamed. And I woke up the next morning disoriented for the first time in my life with nowhere to be. I had taken a quick detour off my conveyor belt. I had been forcibly thrown off the path I had gotten on the second I decided I wanted to do science when I was a little kid. I felt untethered, free-falling, and I hated it. So I went to a coffee shop with all the other unemployed Brooklynites and edited my resume. And when I was done, I looked at it. Everything I have ever been condensed into a one-sheet PDF, myself in bullet points. And it looked almost pathetic then, staring back at me. And I scrolled through all the research science job openings in New York and all the upcoming PhD cycles on the East Coast, and I was qualified for all of them, but my mouse hovered over every apply button, never clicking. Did I really want to do it all over again? Like, now that I'd seen the light, seen the other side, I wasn't sure if I could go back the other way. And even though it was messy and chaotic and fucking brutal, comedy made me feel like this big, bright sun. And even though you couldn't control how much stage time you got or if someone heckled you or a million things, I still liked it. I still wanted to be in that fiery pit of hell with all the other comics screaming my head off. I guess I thought if I could become a scientist, I could just be a scientist of my own life. Another way to pull my own marionette strings from above. But no one can control their own life. Not even me. I think I was just a test subject all along, you know, accidentally disproving my own hypothesis. So I clicked out of my 284 job tabs. Figured I would give myself 1 week to think about science, to think about comedy, to think about the plan, or if I needed a plan. That was 2 years ago. And my life now looks nothing like I planned or what I thought. And that's okay. I get to do comedy every night. I have a part-time day job where I don't have to touch urine. It's great. It's great. And it's not the plan, but it's better than the plan because I let go of the plan. Well, I got fired. But I accepted being fired. And that's progress, right? I don't know. Even though I lost my job, I got to see this whole new way of looking at the world beyond just a petri dish and my own place in it. And I guess that's why we can't have women in STEM. Thanks so much, guys.
This is Risk. This is Emily Lewis behind me now. And we just heard from Sarah Adelman. SarahAdelmanComedy.com is where to find her online. And Sarah's award-winning short film, Busted, a 13-minute film adaptation of the story you just heard, is currently on the festival circuit. It's playing February at the New York Comedy Film Festival, and in March at Cinequest in San Jose. You can find out more on Sarah's Instagram at SarahAdelman1. Now don't forget to check out my latest check-in over at patreon.com/risk. And don't forget about my new online storytelling workshop starting on February 15th. You can email me at kevin@risk-show.com to learn more. This episode was directed by Hope Brush and edited by Taj Easton. Both of the stories were coached by Michelle Walson and edited by Hope Brush. Thanks to our business director, JC Cassis, our casting director, Cindy Freeman, who wants you to send us your story pitches at risk-show.com/submissions. And I am Kevin Allison, telling you folks, today's the day. Take a risk.